Well, a slightly different kind of session, because for the first 25 minutes or so, we'll be having a tape, and the introduction to the speaker there is going to be self-explanatory. What I've labeled this particular session is a moral minority, ? And the major speaker is Robert McAfee Brown, a distinguished American theologian. His name is on the blackboard. And then when we're done with the tape, we will have time for discussion before the 11:50 lunch. And I'm doing this to present a different viewpoint on something on which I've written also, and I thought it would be useful to compare viewpoints on this. So I'll just start with no further ado, and we'll see what happens.
Welcome to Westminster Church. I'm Donald Meisel, minister in company with my colleagues, to and with the people of this downtown congregation. Today marks the fifth in our series of Thursday noon town hall forums, free and open to the public, and gathered under the overarching theme, Voices of Conscience, Key Issues in Ethical Perspective. Now, why, you may ask, is this congregation, in league with other groups and concerned individuals, bringing these well-known, well-respected, well-versed speakers to town to share their concerns, insights, and convictions? It's because we see it as our obligation as part of the community of faith to raise the voice of conscience in the community and to hold up an ethical plumb line, if you will, against which we can measure ourselves as a community and as a nation. It's not that we or our speakers have all the answers, but at least we can agree that it's important to be asking the right questions. Our speaker today is one who for several decades has been asking the hard questions and pursuing the not easy answers. He is Robert McAfee Brown, who has taught at McAllister, at Stanford University, and at Union Theological Seminary in New York. And currently, he is professor of theology and ethics at the Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, California. Dr. Brown lived on the cutting edge of the civil rights movement in the 60s, on the cutting edge of the anti-Vietnam War protest in the 1970s, and he is profoundly concerned about an issue, among others, facing us in the 80s. And concerning which he's here to speak to us now. We're glad to have you here, Dr. Brown.
Thank you very much, Dr. Meisel. I'm very glad to be here and to see many friends in this audience from the times when I was once a resident of the Twin Cities. I'm going to speak on the topic, the need for a moral minority. Some of you may have misread that title and assumed that I was going to talk about the moral majority. I am going to make some references to the moral majority in the course of these remarks, but I do not want to concentrate exclusively on that moment. I particularly do not want to have the moral majority setting my agenda or our agendas for the 80s. I think that agenda is somewhat politically naive and theologically unbiblical, and I'll try to footnote that in a little while. But my overall concern this morning is much more how we can relate religion and politics positively, and if along the way we can learn some things from the moral majority about how not to do it, I'm willing to call that a gain. This whole problem of a religious presence on the political scene, which has been highlighted for us in this rather recent emergence of the theological right wing, the problem of religion on the political scene is illustrated for me by a comment from an anonymous 17th century writer, one of my favorite anonymous comments. This writer wrote, "I had rather see coming toward me a whole regiment with drawn swords than one lone Calvinist convinced that he's doing the will of God." Now, that statement illustrates both the glory and the demonry of Calvinism, and by not very difficult extension, the potential glory and potential demonry of all political involvement on the part of religiously minded persons. On the one hand, there is something immensely freeing and energizing about feeling that one is doing God's will and that the outcome of one's activity is therefore safe in God's hands. Such an attitude can liberate one to new kinds of courage, to immense risk-taking, even to the point of death. Archbishop Romero of El Salvador, the first anniversary of whose martyrdom we will be remembering next week, is surely an example of this. He became convinced that the junta in his country, the one we are currently supporting, was an instrument of injustice and repression against the poor, and he said so boldly and loudly, knowing the risks. And soon after he began speaking out, he was gunned down in the very act of saying Mass for his people. There have been glorious chapters in the history of faith that have been written and enacted by those who felt that in commitment to God's will, they had to oppose the will of other human leaders. But there can be a demonry as well in the invoking of God's support, which we find exhibited when individuals or groups decide what they want to impose on others and then claim divine sanction for it. This gives them carte blanche to do whatever they feel is necessary to stop their opponents, since their opponents, being opposed to them, are clearly opposed to God as well, and do not finally deserve the right to speak or act or persuade. And Christians have often been guilty of this. The Crusades were an example. Christian anti-Semitism is another. And sometimes the Christian willingness to kill, whether in support of a Nazi ideology or extreme nationalism, whether of the Russian or American variety, these are other instances that come to mind. And as I look at the current American religious scene, it is this tendency that seems to me in danger of characterizing this recently emerged religious right, of which moral majority is at least one very clear-cut example. Mr. Falwell, Jerry Falwell, the leader of that movement, states that he knows just what is wrong with our country, and he tells us, and I quote, "God has called me to action. I have a divine mandate to go into the halls of Congress and fight for laws that will save America," end of quote. And as this position develops, it turns out that those who disagree with him are really by definition disagreeing with God, since he and not they have access to God's will. Liberals, for example, whom Mr. Falwell abominates, are not just political liberals or theological liberals, they are godless liberals. They are the ones who must be removed from public office, since they're not only wrong, but evil. What we must have in office are God-fearing, Bible-believing Christians, which is bad news to Jews and secularists. Now, I do not for a moment challenge Mr. Falwell's right or anybody's right to get into the American political process, to work for change, to support candidates, urge people to vote, and all the rest. That's the way the American system works, and the more people that are doing that, the better for the health of the system. And it would be a very perverse logic to claim that only people with whom I agree ought to be engaging in political activity, and I want no part of such an argument. I've taken my own political stands in the past. I intend to keep doing so in the present and future. So can and should every one of you and everyone else, whether named Billy Graham or Bill Coffin, whether named Jerry Falwell or Robert Drynan. Furthermore, this emergence of the radical right on the political scene means that there's one ancient battle we're not going to have to fight for a while. For most of my adult life, at any rate, people on the theological right have been saying, religion and politics don't mix. The rest of us have been saying, they do too mix. And now, for better or for worse, that message has been heard. The question is no longer, do religion and politics mix? The question is simply, what is the nature of the mix? And it's the nature of the mix, as far as groups like Moral Majority are concerned, that is increasingly concerning me, and even on some levels beginning to frighten me. Now let me say just enough about that kind of mix so that I can then set the stage in the latter part of these comments for what seems to me a more appropriate alternative. In Christian terms, but I think in terms with which all Jews could also agree, my real complaint about the Moral Majority's intrusion of the Bible into American politics is that they aren't biblical enough. I do not for a moment concede that they have the Bible on their side and the rest of us are nothing but godless liberals or secular humanists, which in Mr. Fall's lexicon is very close to being either a socialist or a communist. So let me illustrate that in two ways. First of all, it seems to me that the Moral Majority's biblically inspired political agenda involves a very selective, very partial, and therefore very distorted use of the Bible. They have isolated a set of concerns that they say get to the heart of what is wrong with America. And you know that list. Homosexuality, abortion, pornography. These are the things that are wrong and are destroying our nation. What we need to do, what do we need to be for? Basically, for prayer in public schools and for more bombs. Jesus wants our kids to pray, and he wants the Pentagon to be able to kill more people if necessary. Now, I know that sounds a little crude, but I believe it is. I'm not denying that there are moral dimensions involved in all those issues, and that people can take different moral positions in response to them. But the notion that they represent what the Hebrew and Christian scriptures offer us as the key for understanding what is wrong with the world today, such a notion strikes me as grotesque. Take this issue of homosexuality. If one turns to the scriptures as a whole to try to come up with their central concerns, homosexuality is going to be very low on such a list, even if indeed it makes the list at all. There are maybe seven very ambiguous verses in the whole biblical canon that even allude to it. And I will any day subordinate that minuscule import of those seven verses, isolated verses, to hundreds and hundreds of places where the scriptures are dealing over and over again with questions of social justice. The tendency of the rich to exploit the poor. The need for all of us to have a commitment to the hungry. The need for nations not to put their major trust in armaments, the concern for the sick, the recognition that all people, whoever they are children of God, even if they're Russians or Cubans or Salvadorians. The Moral Majority, I'm suggesting, creates an agenda, and then proceeds to impose that agenda on Scripture by developing little strings of unrelated verses to give divine sanction to the position. Now, as all of those of you who work with the Bible know, you can prove absolutely anything that way. You can make a biblical case for militarism or pacifism, for nationalism or internationalism, for male dominance or for women's rights, though it's a little harder with women's rights, I've got to concede. You can make a case for capital punishment, or for letting the prisoners go free. You can make a case for socialism or capitalism, simply by selecting the verses very carefully and ignoring all the others. Now let me make that point in a more positive way, in a second reaction to Moral Majority. It seems to be clear there are great and central overriding themes and concerns in the scriptures. You and I might have slightly different lists of what those themes would be, but there would be certain ones we simply could not ignore if we were going to respond honestly to the texts. There are huge sections, for example, on the dangers of national idolatry, that is to say, making the nation into God, accepting uncritically whatever we have to do as a nation against other nations. Those things, those major emphases stand in very sharp contrast to Mr. Falwell's assessment that we should have done whatever we needed to do to win in Vietnam because our national honor was at stake. That was the criterion. And I submit that national honor is a criterion the Bible unremittingly attacks. There are long sections in Scripture dealing with the need to be concerned about the poor and the destitute. There are treatments of the virus of racism. There are many recognitions that those with wealth will always be tempted to act repressively against the poor, and so on and so on. And the breathtaking thing to me is that when one looks over the agendas of the moral majority, there's absolutely no mention of such things. There's a kind of total silence. We seem to be living in two different worlds, reading two different books. Let me summarize that difference then in this way. It seems to me there's some biblical passages that help to pull together many others, that help to encapsulate much of that message. I'd suggest that one such passage is Jesus' famous picture or parable of the Last Judgment. That represents his indictment of what's wrong in our society and how it should be changed. I remember Mr. Falwell's indictment: pornography, abortion, homosexuality, no prayers in public schools, too little money for defense spending. How does this biblical indictment go? In Jesus' assessment, the nations, not just individuals, we need to remember that story of the Last Judgment is addressed to the nations. The nations are called to account, and here are the kinds of things in terms of which the nations will be judged. On whether or not as a nation we gave food to the hungry, whether or not as a nation we gave drink to the thirsty, whether or not as a nation we took in strangers, whether or not as a nation we clothed the naked, whether or not as a nation we visited the sick, whether or not as a nation we went to those in prison, and whether or not as a nation we did these things not just for folks like us, but to the very least of our sisters and brothers. So I say, yes, let the moral majority take an agenda to the American people. Let them call it a message which is based on special concern for the middle class. Let them appeal, if they wish, more to fears than to hopes. Let them make a patriotic pitch to keep America number one at all costs in the arms race. But let them not, I say, call that biblical. Let them not say that is a platform toward which the Jewish and Christian scriptures are pushing us. Well, all right, where do we go when that's been said? I'm convinced, first of all, it is important to have said it, to clear the air a bit, but then we need to begin to look in some different directions. And I would like to start that looking by rejecting attempts to juxtapose the words moral and majority. I don't think they belong together. I don't think the Jewish and Christian scriptures talk about moral majorities. I think they talk about remnants, about minorities. And Christians have a lot to learn from Jews about this. The Hebrew prophets were invariably on the side of the minority. They were taking on the status quo. They were getting into trouble. They never played the numbers game. Amos would never have gotten even third prize in the Bethel Chamber of Commerce competition for promising young dressers of sycamore trees. And you can be sure he never would have maintained a TV rating beyond the first week of a broadcast. There's a professor at Fuller Seminary, Bill Pennell, who says, you know, the book of Amos is full of quotations, and none of them make good bumper stickers. Now, in the Jewish Christian perspective, the truth is not likely to be found with the majorities, but with the minorities, the remnants. In the Bible, I think truth comes in small packages. It was when the early Christians became the moral majority in the Roman Empire around the 4th century that things started going to pieces. Once Constantine recognized Christianity as the official religion, this little oppressed minority began acting like an oppressing majority. The Pope raised armies, conversions were forced, there were pogroms, rights of those who disagreed were suppressed, unbelievers were tortured and killed, And this is a set of policies that, as long as they could, our own Protestant forebears carried on in their day. Now, I think the human family has had enough of a taste of what one could call this Christendom mentality, in which Christians decide to try to run the show for everybody else. And I don't think we want it back under Constantine or Jerry Falwell or anyone else. The trouble with moral majorities is that they tend to see themselves as moral monopolies. So I suggest that the need is to build moral minorities, to create groups that will try to be a leaven in our national lump, that will say some of the things most people don't necessarily want to hear, that will try to avoid simplistic answers, that will acknowledge complexities, that will seek arenas for debate rather than a fundamentalistic fulmination, and it will try to enlarge our vision beyond national boundaries to global perspectives. So let me now, to conclude, suggest very briefly five characteristics that I think would be appropriate to the moral minority. And I say that since Jews have had a long history of being a moral minority, we Christians have some things to learn from them, and I hope they'll begin to share long years of wisdom with us. But I will not now try to speak for Jews, which would be condescending, but suggest some things that we as Christians out of our own heritage could begin to do to become a moral minority. First, I said a moment ago that the Bible doesn't talk about majorities as much as about remnants. Since the demise of what we've called this Constantinian Christianity, where Christians were running the show, and that demise took place several hundred years ago, only a lot of Christians haven't heard that word yet. Since that time, this remnant posture has become both appropriate and descriptive for Christians. We are a small percentage, a remnant of the whole human family, particularly when we look at ourselves globally. But let me suggest even a further refinement of that image. A moral minority might be called a remnant within the remnant. By and large, institutional Christianity is going to reflect the culture around it more than it will challenge it. But there could be a remnant within that remnant that would find some ways to offer a different model. There's an exciting set of experiences out of the church in Latin America that offers a way of thinking about that model. For centuries, as you know, the Catholic Church in Latin America was at the beck and call of the little group of the wealthy who had all the power, who had all the money, who had all the prestige, and had enough military hardware to keep everybody else in line. But in recent years, the churches have been getting away from that uncritical alliance with those in power. And there have grown up literally tens of thousands of what they call comunidades de base, base communities, or grassroots communities. These people do not wait for the word to come down through an ecclesiastical chain of command. They tackle a local problem, oppression by a local large landholder, or inadequate wages to live on, or the disappearance of someone who's speaking out politically, and they look for ways to act, perhaps 15 or 20 of them together. And they put all this in the context of their ongoing liturgical life. In the midst of prayer, Bible study, the Eucharist, they try to combine what they call reflection and action. They become a leaven in the life of the larger church, and hope gradually that thereby the larger church can become a leaven in the even larger community. And I think we could create models in our own communities that would take that kind of experiment seriously. Is there a local problem here in Minneapolis that nobody's tackling that needs attention? A small group could begin to deal with it, maybe from within one church, maybe across denominational lines, or by concerned folk who are Christians and Jews and whoever, whatever the nature of the mix calls for. The point is, one doesn't need to be a loner. One also doesn't have to have a huge structure behind one in order to begin to act. Now, secondly, what would be the resources such a group could employ? Here, I think we've got a couple of very good things going for us. One of them, as I've already suggested, is the Bible. If we could break out of the kind of culturally conditioned ways we've read the Bible, we would find it an explosive arsenal of materials for creative change. In the last few years, I've had to begin rereading the Bible in the light of what I've learned from Christians in such places as Latin America, trying to see it through their eyes, hear it with their ears. And I'm amazed at what is in this book. We tend to spiritualize away all the rough edges. And the Bible talks about good news to the poor. We immediately heard that to mean spiritually poor, spiritually impoverished, and we're all part of that, so there's no rough edge left. Now, I'm sure that's part of what was meant, but it seems to me very clear what it also meant, that when Jesus was talking about the poor, he also meant the materially poor, the really impoverished, who didn't have enough to eat, who didn't have enough food, who didn't have enough power. That when he said the poor have the good news preached to them, that's part of what he meant, those people down on the bottom of the pile. What if liberty to the oppressed, which was another part of Jesus' message, means those living not simply under the oppression of neuroses or other middle-class ailments, but those who are oppressed as victims of economic and political and military oppression? We have a phrase that's in Jesus' sermon at Nazareth, which talks about proclaiming what our translations call the acceptable year of the Lord. That washes right over us. What was that referring to? That was the Jubilee year, which is about as political as you can get. Debts were to be forgiven, slaves were to be freed, land was to revert to its former owners. There's plenty of stuff within this old black book for a minority posture to emerge. So we can also realize that we've dealt with our own past Christian history in very selective ways. We've known all about that church that emerged triumphantly in the 4th century, and a lot of people wish it were still around. But before that, Christians were this little minority, a tiny handful, quite analogous to what we in our world today are becoming. Maybe those first centuries are a clue to what we should be about. Welcoming the down and outers, challenging Caesar, cutting across lines that divide people off from one another, being the place where those whom the world calls worthless are treated as having infinite worth. We look at the Reformation, we Protestants, and we trot out Luther and Calvin and maybe Thomas Hooker or some other Anglican, and we forget that there were other people involved in the Reformation. Quakers, Mennonites, Anabaptists, Diggers, Levelers, the crazies, we like to think, who were doing such things as challenging the right and the fitness of Christians going to war, who were challenging the right of governments to be the definers of conscience, who were casting their lot with the poor. There's a whole lot of that heritage we have buried that maybe we need to recover. So there's a biblical and an historical resource we could bring to bear. The third thing the moral minority could stress, perhaps the most important thing in the time in which we live, would be the necessity of a global perspective. This world is now just too small to allow for anything else. And to look at the world simply in terms of what is good for the United States is finally going to be self-defeating. To put the main stress and priority on more weapons, as the national debate is now suggesting, is surely likely to increase the likelihood that we'll use them. A perspective can no longer be national or regional, it has to be global. And in terms of the remnant within the remnant, the great thing, it seems to me, that we have going for us is that we don't have to start out and create that global community from scratch. It already exists. There is a little network of courageous people all over the world, some of whose courage might even begin to rub off on us. I've been fortunate in the last few years to have visited some parts of the world I never expected to get to. Chile, Argentina, Cambodia, Laos, Kenya, South Africa, Russia, India. What impresses me is that in places where it is not expedient to do so and involves great risks, little groups of people speak and act in defiance of what repressive governments demand of them. They refuse a sheerly nationalistic perspective. They insist on seeing who they are in relation to everyone else. Dom Helder Kamerow in Brazil, Alan Bosak and Desmond Tutu in South Africa, many courageous folk in repressive regimes in Chile and Argentina, which our administration is about to reward with more shipments of arms, ministers in South Korea, who are whoever or wherever, there is the moral minority where people are taking their lives, putting their lives on the line every time they speak. This brotherhood, this sisterhood of the remnant within the remnant, the moral minority already exists, and we could be empowered by them. If they can risk their lives, we might at least risk a little bit of our reputations. That suggests a fourth thing the moral minority might become. It could be that group in our society which is genuinely committed to the powerless and the voiceless. The World Council of Churches and Pope John Paul II have recently been describing the task of the church as being, as they say, the voice of the voiceless, insisting that the church must speak on behalf of those who cannot speak, act on behalf of those who cannot act. I now think we have to improve on that. Rather than just trying to be the voice of the voiceless, the church, it seems to me, or at least the moral minority in the church, must be that place where the voiceless are empowered to speak on their own behalf and are guaranteed a hearing. Instead of the church speaking through some kind of microphone to the world on behalf of the voiceless, the church must be the place where the microphone is offered to those who haven't been able to gain access to it. Now you'd have to decide what this might mean in Minnesota. Who are the powerless here? Indians? Members of other minority groups? Women? A moral minority would try to see to it that the ones without representation, the ones denied a hearing, the ones written off by the rest of the society, could be heard and taken seriously and empowered. Fifth and finally, I think a moral majority must, as I've been implying, set its own agendas. You may not like the ones I've been suggesting so far. Certainly there can be others. That would be one thing to deal with among members of a moral minority. But our agendas must not be set by the moral majority movement. We must not fall into a trap of single-issue politics, or politics narrowly conceived around a tiny set of issues. I find it kind of morally oppressive to be told again and again that some kind of obsession about other people's sex life is the burning issue of the day, when the majority of the human family is going to bed hungry every night. Or to be told to rally around getting prayers back into school when millions of people are unable to find jobs or get minimal help if they're unemployed and disadvantaged. So I hope we can find ways to begin to rally around the problems where the whole human family is hurting, the mad escalation of the arms race, the need for more equitable distribution of food, coming to terms with denials both abroad and at home of basic human rights to things like education and medical care and jobs and all the rest. And I think we need to do this in a context which provides a forum for seeking the good of all, not just small segments of the population, trying to present issues without demagoguery or cheating, acknowledging that problems are complex and that simplistic solutions will be misleading and wrong, and acknowledging also that ambiguities abound not only within the positions of those with whom we disagree, but within our own positions as well. With some such way of engaging in political life, we might be able to create a moral minority that could propose convictions without arrogance, insight without absolutism, commitment without coercion, and democracy without demagoguery. Thank you.
Okay. The floor is open.
Yeah. I would like to defend Jerry Falwell. I do not agree with Jerry Falwell.
Falwell.
But I'd like to defend him. I'd like to draw a little correlation here. Let's assume that all Christians are sheep, and that Dr. Brown and Jerry Falwell are both sheep. It seems to me that Christians, in the last number of years, we've been very concerned about all these wolves around us, the humanistic tendencies and a concern with the self and the people with the bigger baskets and so forth. We've been looking at these wolves around us. Jerry Falwell kind of reminds me as maybe of a sheep that grabbed a bugle and blew it, but he didn't blow it very well. He did it wrong. And Dr. Brown immediately jumps on Jerry Falwell, and he says, you know, he blew the bugle poorly, and he's not moral, he's not a majority, and he drags Falwell out, and the attention is on Falwell. I keep pronouncing the name wrong. Consequently, it's much easier for these wolves, with this attention on Falwell, to proceed even at a faster rate. And I think the main danger that we have in the Christian community. I don't support Dr. Brown or Dr. Falwell, and I think that that's a mistake that we're making, is that they're heaping mud on each other, and the dangers that both are concerned about are increasing at a more rapid rate than they would otherwise.
As I say, the agenda is open. I've got lots, but I'm here to, you know, just to encourage.
One of the things that he made clear at the very beginning was that he is certainly open to and supports Jerry Falwell's and anyone's, you know, right to enter into the political process and to be a part of that and to, you know, support causes that they think are important and all of those things. And feels that he has a right to do that too. And I'm not sure if I understood, you know, just what was being said there, but I think he really made that clear. And I think right at the very end there, he also said that it was important for us not to assume that we had all the right answers either, but to be critical, evaluating ourselves and our own struggle through all of the issues. But if someone takes a position like he has done, like Jerry Falwell has done, and supports it on the basis of the biblical understanding, you know, it's really important for others to enter in with their critical analysis and evaluation of their biblical understanding too, enter into that whole process. I think it's good. I think it's good that he has created a lot of that discussion, and I'm almost kind of happy that persuading over the tackle.
What it boils down for me is I lived through out in Wisconsin during the infamous Senator Joe McCarthy days. At that time, if you disagree with Senator Joe McCarthy, you automatically branded as a communist. In the Falwell's instance, what it boils down to, as far as I'm concerned, is if you don't agree with him, and this is what Matthew Brown says too, you're automatically either un-Christian or some other thing, or even perhaps immoral. That's what it boils down to. That's why I don't think he has a right to do what he's doing.
Well, I talked to a congressman from my own district and to all the staff assistants, and the staff particularly was intimidated every single day by his groups going in and insisting that they pray with them. And the tone of the prayer and so forth was, to them, frightening. Now, this particular congressman, a group comes, he'll tell all of me, he says, I've said my prayers before I came here this morning. I'll say them again at noon, and right now I'm busy. So he is really, and of course he is targeted. I think if you understand the way they are operating, then you understand why there is cause for concern. I also remember McCarthy days.
I kept being reminded at the front end of the tape about a quote I heard where something to the effect that God created good people and bad people, and fortunately gave it to the good to define the difference. And I thought, well, gee, I can sure condemn Falwell for that, but I'm not sure I can condemn McAfee Brown for taking that same position. I felt he was more open to what I believe is an open look to the people.
More, Jim?
I listened to Powell on the radio long before he was famous. I had a job where I walked out long distances all by myself, and that Thomas Rhodes Church was very small, and I listened to him in the beginning. Well, to jump forward to Francis Schaeffer, that I also listened to, what both men have in common is a powerful belief in the Bible and a powerful hatred of liberalism and humanism. And let me say one word as I reread the Bible in parts every year. I have a little private joke. I'm very happy that King Solomon was claimed to be the author of Ecclesiastes and Proverbs and the Song of Solomon, or else those great liberal, sexy, and humanistic things would not be in the Bible. And the book of Ecclesiastes especially is very close to the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, which I nurtured myself on in my anti-clerical days. And so, anyway, there's such delight in the Bible. It's richer and more sexy and more down-to-earth and more practical than the primitive capitalism that have greed as their motto, who support Paul.
Other comments? I've got plenty, but...
When Falwell first became famous, I found it an embarrassment to be a Christian, especially living where we do, where we are, white people are a minority, seeing the poverty, the real issues that we are surrounded with all the time in daily life and church life, in town and our government-wise. I still find Falwell to be an embarrassment to Christianity. But I don't think that's what Brown was trying to say. That's not what his message was about. It wasn't an attack on Falwell. It was a call for Christians to mobilize on issues that are of supreme importance to the whole earth, not just to the United States. Not only do I find often Christianity to be an embarrassment for what they have done in the past, what we are doing now, but also our government, our way of life. And I don't want to say that Brown is giving us some answers, but he's giving us some specific steps in how to go about saying things, doing things to counteract those problems.
Well, I think Brown definitely feels that Falwell, I mean, he was definitely attacking Falwell and almost everything that he said, comparing him to Hitler, he did earlier. Not directly, but it certainly implied, and that he was a hypocrite and so forth. And very narrow in his interpretation of the Bible and so on. The fact that Falwell really stepped in where other people kind of feared to tread really made him subject to a lot of attacks. And I would say that that generally this is a consensus in the United States today that of the middle of the road or liberal churches that Falwell is to be attacked. And there's a number of ways you can attack Falwell. I mean, I agree. A number of things he said are very open to attack. But a lot of the things that he has brought up are things that we should be concentrated on. Instead, we're concentrating on attacking Falwell. This is the problem. Maybe if Martin Luther was here today, he could have rated politicians a little better. Maybe he probably wouldn't have even thought of rating politicians. But he would point out the fact that this is really what this man stands for. And this is what the other man stands for. Maybe he could have done it a lot better and wouldn't have been a subject to attack. It seems to me that all of our concern is in the wrong place, and it makes us weaker.
Where should we put our concern?
Well, I think we should put our concern on some of the things that Falwell has raised.
What about the concern of the poor and the oppressed and the militaristic?
I don't believe, it was kind of implied here that Falwell is not in support of the plight of the poor. I'm not sure whether he is or not.
Very obvious.
I haven't found it in his writings.
Well, whether he is or not, maybe we shouldn't even be thinking about Falwell. We should be concerned about our tendency to get bigger baskets.
That's what Maxby Brown is suggesting. That's what he's challenging us to do.
Well, if he's doing that, he shouldn't be talking about Falwell. I don't think. I realize that Falwell isn't a majority, and he probably isn't moral, you know. But Brown is attacking Falwell. And then maybe the focus is on
Falwell. He was doing a lot more than that. He was giving a lot of people a lot of room. And one of his big arguments against Falwell is that Falwell does not want to give us any room.
Yeah, you're talking about the moral report cards that came out measuring the congressman.
Right.
And to list the five issues that Brown mentioned there, and say that on the basis of this, you can determine a person's morality, and then omit, you know, all the other things. The congressman probably votes on hundreds, I suppose, in any given session, hundreds of different issues. And to say that these five are the moral issues and all the rest don't count, or shouldn't be taken into consideration, or there shouldn't be something set in context, is what's causing all the controversy. And as it turned out, one of the Florida congressmen who got 100% from Falwell was convicted on the Abscam trial. You know, he's moral.
Well, that's a good point, though. But of course, you know, with the lady that was caught in adultery, of course, Jesus said to all those who were poor, and she obviously sinned. You know, that to those of you without sin, cast the first stone, they all left. I think this is somewhat of a similar situation.
The base that he uses for measuring morality is simply too small.
Well, not necessarily. I think like the abortion situation. I'll go on a limb. I think this is very important, and I really believe that abortion is wrong. I really do. And generally, they were pretty consistent on the rating on this point. A number of other things, I don't believe that if we increase our military might that we're going to be more secure. I don't believe that at all. But I believe some of the things that Falwell has, and I admire him in the respect that he went out. I don't know exactly what his motives are entirely, but at least he went out and he, like I say, he blew the bugle, even though he blew it badly. We shouldn't be focusing on how badly he blew the bugle, I think. I mean, it leaves a lot of other things to continue the way they have.
Well, I heard Falwell, Bob Brown say that everybody's entitled to their opinion, and let's have an open, free discussion, the open marketplace of ideas, going back to Jefferson, with this, and not put labels on people. Paste labels, because the old cliche here is true, that label is libel. With this, but that to go beyond and build these small moral minorities, the enclaves or the remnants within the remnants, is one positive thing, and to be globally conscious is another thing that he talked about, and to have a wider agenda than simply these particular issues. One thing that's clear in the moral majority issue, that none of them would cost the taxpayers any money. And that's a very comfortable way and a very good way to get to get support, is to propose a program for which you don't have to sacrifice with this. And all of these touch, all of these are very attractive to white middle class people. And leaving out, on the moral report cards, the one that bothered me, and you and I talked about this on the trail the other day, was that Senator Mark Hatfield got a 23. And I would submit, nobody takes his Christian convictions more seriously than Mark Hatfield. Maybe some people from Oregon here would want to disagree, but I would...
No, don't disagree at all. I thoroughly agree with you.
23 out of what,
100%? Yeah. Yeah. You see, the idea that you can, this is what I call moralism in the book. I don't want to give a commercial for my book. Well, I can, because there aren't any copies for sale here anyway. that you can objectify or quantify a person's morality on the basis of their voting record, and say that if a person scored 90%, he must be pretty moral, and then the person who scored 10% or 23%, you see, is, you draw your own conclusions from that. And so on. I saw a hand over here some time ago. Yeah.
I can't think of anybody who needs less defense than Jerry Falwell. When you consider the power he has in the media, this is one thing that is frightening to me. But rather than talk about him, why aren't we thinking about some of those 5 points specifically? Yeah. What can we do? Number one, about these things on the agenda, number one, one that comes to mind is the way we are now working with the Catholic Church in finding out what is going on in El Salvador. I submit that that's one positive thing we can do, and I would like to hear some others.
Yeah, well, of course, the whole agenda, the social agenda here, is pretty much fully in support of the ideas of social justice and the questions of hunger and oppression and the use of natural resources and all the rest. with us, but I'd be, you know, if somebody would like to, you know, to carry on from what she suggested here. Yeah.
Another method for at least finding out information is through Wartburg Seminary on the Namibia issue. There are Wartburg graduates who are living in, well, he's a professor at the seminary in Namibia, which is a predominantly Lutheran country. They send out a newsletter a few times a year. They take in money to help support the political problems in that country. It would be another thing worth working with the Catholics.
I belong to Amnesty International, which gets very low publicity, except once in a great while somebody is set free, as they were in Korea. Mm-hmm. And we had one in Bulgaria Yugoslavia this last winter. That's one positive thing that it seems to me that you can do. But you must all have other things you do in your own area.
Bread for the World would be another,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty clear. And what was interesting, I wish I had my copy of the book here. It's not that what we call moral report cards are in any way new or in and of themselves illegal in Congress. The first quote rating of congressmen came in 1908 by the AFL. All the lobbies and special interest groups have ratings. National Rifle Association has its rating and sends this out to a voter. AFL-CIO has its. How do you vote on labor? Pro or con? Dozens of these and Bread of the World is one that rates these people also. And just to give one example of this, Bread of the World voted McGovern 100% and the moral majority voted him zero. As a contrast. Now, you know, what Brown was saying is that there are some kinds of priorities that take place, and he used homosexuality, mentioned seven times in the Bible as one, as opposed to the number of times the Bible, if you want to play the quantifying numbers game, talks about the need for economic justice. What was the statistic Brown used earlier this week about the number of times that the Bible talks about economic justice? It's the second largest topic in the New Testament for concern, if you want to count, times for this.
Give the Bible a rating.
This was talked about earlier, though. You know, what was it? Somebody referred to a particular book that talked four times as much about communism.
Yeah, that was me.
Well, there's an example there. Yes, it depends on what emphasis you want to put in.
Well, I was trying to make a point that just because I talked a little bit about procreationism and then a lot pro-evolutionism, it didn't mean that I was necessarily in one camp or the other with this. I think what you say is true about the media, and sometimes that gets to be a very frightening thing, because what may happen is that through the use of the media, and also something which I think we're all aware of is the direct mail computer output, that an enormous amount of money, an enormous amount of political clout can be mobilized very quickly by any particular group as it comes in. And what I call the New Christian Right has done is study very carefully the ways in which direct mail can be used. Richard Viguerie is the head figure on this. And there are various other action groups that go along with this. And the reason the right wing has the enormous clout that it does is that it has updated and mobilized the most sophisticated kinds of technology available in the country today. If you want an anti-gun control letter out, you can have something like 20 million pieces of literature in the mail, and they will all be personalized. It'll be, "Dear Mr. Jorston," and my name will appear four or five times in the letter, and then there will be different colors under the underlining certain key passages, as though somebody sat there with a pen with a magic marker and underlined this for me, and as though this was a direct personal letter to me. The reason I found out that it wasn't a direct letter to me personally was that I got a membership card in Christian Voice, which is the Pasadena or California West version of Moral Majority, and they work closely together with us. And my name came out as Jorsted History. I found out that my name wasn't Erlen Jorsted, it was Jorsted History. So
I got one where I teach MCAD, Minneapolis College of Art, and that, "Dear Mr. McCann."
I don't agree with all that Jerry Falwell says, but the fact that he and his groups can get this technology together and send you and me a letter, why aren't...
Oh, yeah, no, this,
the
this
other side will do the same, too.
The technology is open to whoever. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, and absolutely, and what is necessary for the opposition to the far right is to see whether or not they're willing to organize and make the sacrifices necessary to counter this, because the whole rule, what's really happened with the 1980 election is that basically the ground rules of politicking and electioneering in this country have changed. Political parties as such are necessary window dressing. You don't get things done, you don't get the money in, you don't get the votes mobilized, you don't get the voters educated through the parties any longer. Parties are simply there for patronage and window dressing and kind of nostalgia. You hire PR people. California's had this for a long time. It's an outfit called, or a group I should say, called Spencer Roberts, a PR group. They are so good and they are so confident in their abilities that if a candidate running office wants to employ them, they will guarantee, or they will not charge the candidate if he loses. They won't charge, and they've only lost once or twice. I mean, they simply go Democrat, Republican, Vegetarian, Libertarian. They can run on the lottery ticket, and Spencer Roberts can get you elected with this. And what Viguerie, Viguerie started, I'm a historian, so I can't stay away from talking to the history. Viguerie started, first of all, he got started as working for Buckley's Young Americans for Freedom, and then he became George Wallace's campaign director or fundraiser in 1968. And so Viguerie has been studying political campaigning techniques for all these years, and now when direct mail has come through, and the television preachers have come through, Baker, Falwell, Robertson, and who was the other one, I forgot. James Robeson from Fort Worth. Now that these are here, he has everything going for him. And they are so well organized, and they've taken advantage of the new changes in the laws, allowing what we call political action committees to raise these unlimited amounts of funds, that he set a standard. And the best estimates are that the middle of the road to liberal political groups are 6 to 8 years behind in terms of technology. And there's a hit list out now from 1982 of 20 senators. Three are Republican, but those three are on the hit list because they're pro-choice rather than pro-life. And for those of you in Washington may be interested to know that Scoop is on the hit list. And I always thought that Scoop was the best friend the Republicans had in Congress. So he's certainly no threat.
Is Hatfield on that list too?
What?
Is Hatfield on that list too?
He's not up for re-election in 82. Yeah, these are the 82 senators, and even old Hayakawa, because he's pro-choice, and he's about as harmless, because he sleeps most of the time. I like that, but I think I'm glad you mentioned that, and that's what I meant by the report cards too. The report cards are completely legal. Every major group has them. And simply, all the rules of politics have changed.
Well, it's kind of a right and left, though. Of course, there are some Republicans that are pretty close to the left, which Hatfield, of course, falls in that category.
Yes, and course, there are some Democrats right, who are, some Democrats who are way to the right. So, right. John Stennison, who can still get out of bed. I don't know how he can in the morning, but there are those also. And so that's what is so unique about the whole movement into politics. And for the first time, what's happened is that what those we would call conservatives, not conservatives, but evangelicals and fundamentalists have decided that politics isn't dirty, that it isn't corrupt, and that the only way in which they can get things done is to organize and mobilize. And this is what Bob Brown was talking about. And you see, use the power of the national government for, quote, moral change in this country. And this is my own position of what I'm somewhat frightened about and where I see a contradiction in the movement itself. Because as Viguerie and all the others keep saying, what we're trying to do is to get more government out of our lives, get the government off our backs. Take out these billions of dollars from the tax, lower taxes and all the other things. Less government is what they're talking about. Yet, if the programs that they're advocating go through, it would mean that some very intimate parts of our lives, some very private parts of our daily existence, would be under the direct control of a few people in Washington. And the idea of choice, so far as the matter of prayer, for instance, is concerned, and certain sexual lifestyles are concerned, and all the rest is no longer a matter of personal choice, but is in the hands of a few people over whom there is really no kind of control. Yeah.
I think that communication, there's no doubt that communication is really critical to the whole process and awareness of people's communicating their feelings and understandings and getting together and everything, and important for the minority. But I think we really face a struggle or a challenge in the best technology or the best form of communication to use, because what may work the best may not necessarily be the best. There's a lot of power and a lot that can happen through the mass media, as Falwell and the Moral Majority have used it. And I think that we really need to be challenged by that use of it, but that may not be the best way to go about it. And it's a struggle, because you want to use a good way, and yet I think one of the whole approach that McAfee Brown is talking about is the importance of more of a decentralized form of communication, allowing the poor and the voiceless to be able to take the microphone, and as he did the little analogy that he used. And so that if we employ technology and if we employ the media, you know, to really be thinking of that, because there's tremendous power for one way, you know, communication as it's been used, and we need to be careful in how we use.
Because the dangers would be to give too much power to the technology, especially to television, I suppose, and therefore violate what we've always felt would be so important, the First Amendment and everybody's right to speak up as freely as possible. And I think the attractiveness, you see, of Falwell is that they've found a new scapegoat in this country. In the 1950s, I was in Dane County in Madison during the whole thing. So that was fascinating. I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin, and we remember with mixed, feelings, the whole thing. With this, I forgot my point for goodness sake. Let me back up. On communications. Oh, I had a good point already. I hope this isn't on tape, but. Well, the scapegoat thing, yeah, thank you. That in the 50s, we could blame pointy-headed professors and parlor pinks. And Alger Hiss, he was always good to kick around, and a few others. And they found somebody in the agriculture department, and Harry Dexter White, and a few others. And in the 60s, what happened was that we found that the real problems in America had nothing at all to do with quote communism. The real problems were pollution, were sexism, were racism, the overkill in the military. And so it caused a great deal of confusion in the lives of an enormous number of people. And what was popular about the resurgence of the right is the promise that if we go back to the good old days, things will straighten up. And therefore, they had to find some internal enemies rather than saying that everything is a plot from Moscow and that it's being directed, by some master plot. Remember an old name, Fred Schwartz? Does that ring a bell with any of you? Right. In 1973, a Christian anti-communist crusade from Long Beach, California. Communism was going to take over in 1973. Absolutely. Maybe you didn't know that it has. And he was a spinoff from Colonel McIntyre and Billy Jean Curtis and other stalwarts like that. And now the attractiveness of the whole movement, you see, and I think that the attractiveness of the whole conservative resurgence is that in a day of real peril, there's no question, the terrorism, the assassinations, the frightening things that happened in Iraq, all these things have made this world a much more terrible and frightening place. The dangers of pollution, world starvation, and all these things. And for many people, rather than move in the direction that Brown is talking about with empowering the poor and the oppressed and all the rest, it's simply easier to fall back on old traditional ways which seemed in the past to have worked, but if you look at the past, they really didn't work that well. And hence, I think we're in for, I'll just conclude with this because it's launches at 10:02, that we're in for a very long and difficult and complicated process of politicking and sloganeering, as he said. You can't put Amos on a bumper sticker. I like that. Jim can have the last word.
Also, I don't want the last.
Well, I dedicated my book to him and Emily, so I think he's entitled to the last.
Speaking of Paola, I have an unmarked copy of the book that I bought at Augsburg.
Okay.
Beyond the one you gave me. And I'd be happy to sell it to someone for the price that I paid for it.
All right, thank you for coming, and I'll be glad to talk about it.
That's not my last word.
Oh, the last word was the last word. That was the last word.
The lady turns.